Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And now here's something we hope you'll really like. A recording of a panel I was on a couple of weeks ago about technology and psychedelics with Team Human friends Dr. Julie Holland, Paul D. Miller, aka DJ Spooky, and Ken Jordan, editorial director of Lucid News, which is what the panel was meant to support and promote. Lucid News is an interesting journal about the state of psychedelics, consciousness technologies, and the future of wellness. It's one of the only genuinely responsible places for quality psychedelic journalism. And this matters, as we'll discuss on the panel, because there's a pretty intense competition going on for who is going to establish the set and setting for the psychedelic future. They let me name the panel, so I called it The Secret History and Unwritten Future of Psychedelics and Technology, hoping we could get into both the psychedelic origins of the internet, as well as the way that tech bros now want to monopolize psychedelics as an industry. We did it at the Athenaeum in Manhattan. It's a library of psychedelic books and co-working space. I bet you never thought you'd hear that construction, in front of about 100 really sweet people. This was a good one, and I hope you like it.
Without further ado, we are leaping into The Secret History and Unwritten Future of Psychedelics and Technology. We have with us three, I would say, insightful experts on the topic, each in their own way.
And I'll start. How so, Ken?
I'm going to surprise you. And we'll start with Julie. Julie Holland, Dr. Julie Holland, with you short little bios here, is an author and psychiatrist, psychopharmacologist. She was formerly a weekend attending physician at Bellevue Hospital's Psych ER, which led her to write the bestseller Weekends at Bellevue, which has been translated into 11 languages. Her most recent book is Good Chemistry, The Science of Connection from Soul to Psychedelics. While now a medical advisor to MAPS, she was a medical monitor for several clinical studies examining the efficacy of using MDMA-assisted psychotherapy or cannabis in the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. Immediately to Julie's left, Douglas Rushkoff, named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. Crazy. Douglas Rushkoff is an author and documentarian who studies human autonomy in a digital age. His 20 books include the recently published Survival of the Richest, Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires, as well as Team Human, based on his podcast, and the bestsellers Present Shock, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, Program or Be Programmed, Life, Inc., and Media Virus. And to my immediate right is Paul D. Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, that subliminal kid. Paul Miller, a.k.a. DJ Spooky, is currently artist in residence at Yale University, Center for Collaborative Arts and Media. He is a composer, multimedia artist, and writer whose work engages audiences in a blend of genres, global culture, and environmental and social issues. Miller has collaborated with an array of recording artists, including Ryuichi Sakamoto, Metallica, Chuck D from Public Enemy, Steve Reich, and Yoko Ono, among many others. His 2018 album, DJ Spooky Presents Phantom Dance Hall, debuted at number 3 on Billboard Reggae. His books include the award-winning Rhythm Science, published by MIT Press, Sound Unbound, an anthology about digital music and media, and The Imaginary App, on how apps changed the world. And my name is Ken Jordan. I am the co-founder and editorial director of Lucid News, which is a journalism web platform that covers the psychedelics ecosystem, and which you can find at lucid.news, and also the knowledge platform, which is running in beta online, called Psychedelic U, psychedelicletteru.net. But in a previous life, which many of you probably do not realize, I was involved with digital media in the dot-com days when I launched the first multimedia music website, SonicNet, which sold the first digital music file. And I co-edited the first textbook about the history of computer-based media, Multimedia from Wagner to Virtual Reality, which actually both Douglas and Paul at various times have used in their classes.
Cool.
So we're going to talk about psychedelics and computers. And to kick it all off, I'm going to ask each of you the same question, if you could answer in 30 seconds or less. What could the tech industry learn from psychedelics? Or, in your opinion, what should it learn?
Balance, honoring sort of dark, mysterious yin energy instead of being quite so yang heavy, I think would be good for all of us.
Computer industry wouldn't be here without psychedelics. I mean, that was all my early work, was about how all of these companies needed to hire deadheads and acid takers in order to be able to imagine, to sort of hallucinate virtual realities into existence. They were the only ones who weren't afraid. It was, you know, either you hired a psychedelics person or you found a child, right? And everybody else couldn't do it. And I think what we can learn from psychedelics, or at least from the psychedelic culture, is that the set and setting with which you deploy and manifest a technology is going to determine how it works, you know. And our current internet set and setting is surveillance, control, and exponential growth. And, you know, we've been living on that particular psychedelic substrate for 35 years, and no wonder we're having such a bad trip.
You know, Ken, to go to the heart of the question, I love the sense that psychedelics comes from the Greek term psyche, which is essentially a Greek muse. And eerily enough, the notion of sort of better living through chemistry was a mantra from DuPont Corporation, which I always chuckle about. But here we are in the attention economy. And Doug, to dovetail on what you were just talking about, the attention economy has now displaced the production of physical goods pretty much at every level. Trillions and trillions of dollars based on sort of the machinery of perception. So eerily enough, in this era of obviously this year, 2024, they're having the most amount of elections in human history. I believe 50 to 60 countries are having elections worldwide. And most of that's going to be influenced by literally influence campaigns. So using misinformation, AI, all sorts of stuff. So the politics of perception, that politics literally, as we think of, like, say, for example, Trump, I like to call him president as malware, you know, kind of. And the way that you think about psychedelics, eerily comes from this notion of, like, being able to visualize different modalities of perception. So the Silicon Valley ethos of move fast and break things needs a remix. You know, there we go.
My 30-second take on that is discovering or rediscovering the importance of being in your body. Because for me, psychedelics are very much an embodied experience, and we're kind of living in a culture that seems to be moving farther and farther away from having that sense of physical connection. Julie, would you like to pick up on that?
Well, I don't want to change my answer, but I thought of one more time. Like, wait, I don't want to say balance. Was it playfulness, play, you know? Creativity sort of comes from pushing the boundaries a little bit. And I certainly think that one could be in a more creative, playful state if one took the right things.
Let's explore that. there's a lot of psychedelic action happening right now in Silicon Valley. And it's hard to tell exactly where that's all going and how people are actually moving that into their experience as engineers, how they end up using it in the digital realm that is being developed. Doug, how could they maybe use it differently or better?
I want to go back to the play thing, which is that. I mean, the Silicon Valley tech bro mindset is sort of addicted to the utilitarian application of things. So if they're going to look at psychedelics, they're going to say, well, what's the utility value of this psychedelic? Because they even look at humans. What's the utility value of, how can I increase Julie's utility value to the economy by drugging her with psychedelics? Rather than what we, I believe, got out of psychedelics was that, oh, life is about play, right? Dogs don't chase each other to practice for the hunt. Dogs hunt and eat so they have energy to play and chase each other. And I think there's a kind of a psychedelic, a Homo Ludens, it's a book by Huizinga where he makes that argument that play is sort of the essential human activity. And I think that's the thing I would want to tell tech bros. It's like, it's not about the application. It's about sort of more divine, sacred purpose, if you will.
You know, I want to riff on that from the viewpoint of anti-play. Because eerily enough, here we are in late capitalism, and most people are just living to pay their bills. So it's been fascinating to see with this economy that's been disinterred since the pandemic. One could argue that there's been a radical shift of consolidation of wealth. So most people lost certain economic agency over the last couple of years, and then a very small percentage of people, obviously the billionaire class and so on, have consolidated and gained wealth at an incredible amount of transfer. But eerily enough, there's a term called cultural capital, which a couple of French philosophers, as one does in Paris, came up with an engaging sense of how do we think about new approaches to generating value. So when you're talking about utility, when you're thinking about production, Marx had this infamous phrase, which sounds very psychedelic through Engels, where he says all that's solid melts into air after a certain amount of economic activity. Mm-hmm. And eerily enough, here we are where this idea of the internet itself has transformed to what Marshall McLuhan would have called the global brain. But the molecules that drive that, for me at least, are right now everything from fossil fuel to plastics to other things that are highly toxic. And we need to rethink our relationship to nature as it's been displaced by capital. So these are kind of things that if you go to the very first paintings ever made, people went into a cave where there was darkness. And why would they go into a cave and put their hands on a wall and leave a silhouette that we would see tens of thousands of years later? Probably because they were on a substance. And there's a lot of theories about the origins of both psychedelics and creativity. So the oldest cave paintings, a lot of people are realizing there was a psychoactive involvement in ritual and time. Just saying.
So how do we bring play in an active way into the psychedelic experience of folks who are working on technology if they're not currently getting that message from the significant psychedelic work that they're doing? Work maybe is not quite the right word, but you know, certainly the Burning Man culture is a big part of Silicon Valley.
Right. But you know, I remember everyone was talking about microdosing a while back, and all of a sudden all I heard about microdosing was like Silicon Valley is using it not for creativity but for productivity. And I think that's what Doug is getting at. It can't be all about productivity and capitalism. And you were talking about, you know, sort of unrestricted growth, which in medicine, unrestricted growth is cancer. So we don't like unrestricted growth where I live. And, you know, somebody needs to explain that very basic idea that like after growth is pruning, you know, and you pull back and you see what's important and what matters. And then it's stronger when it'll finally fruit. But if you keep growing and it gets bushier and bushier, it's not going to fruit.
Yeah, but these guys will take the notion of pruning very literally. You know, it's like the guy who pushed the button in the Avengers movie or something. Oh, let's prune humanity, you know.
So that's, I mean, this is actually I'm kind of confused a little bit about where the literalism in that experience comes from to essentially trump the psychedelic experience that is prevalent in Silicon Valley, if you know what I mean. Like, is it because they're all in their jobs so deeply that they're having a hard time stepping back?
I feel like many of them have leaned into a certain a certain kind of autism that gives them a sort of a distanced systemic view of things, sort of a SimCity-like understanding of the world, you know, rather than sort of mixing other sensibilities in with the autism to get, you know, a deep systems experience.
But, you know, what's so wild, though, is that in the counterculture of the 1960s, LSD, if you guys remember, Albert Hofmann was the inventor of it. He was a Swiss chemist who infamously accidentally took the first acid trip because he was in the middle of doing some synthesis, and he rode a bicycle home. And he said the experience of riding the bicycle on this probably very strong acid in the Swiss Alps and mountains made him feel like this idea of a psychological topology unfolding, as one does, you know.
Very strong, but very pure.
Yeah, very pure. So, amusingly enough, Albert Hofmann's kind of descriptions of that first acid trip remind me, amusing enough, of Lewis Carroll here. We have the wonderful Cheshire Cat staring at us here, where Lewis Carroll would call Alice in Wonderland a parable of many dimensions or a parable of mathematics. And I'm fascinated with, here we are in the world of large numbers. There's so much data around us, so much data going through every possible aspect of human creativity right now, that we're in the era of post-quantification, like quantified self. For example, I walk a lot. I use my watch to keep track of my steps, running, so on. But everything is on that kind of algorithmic dimensionality right now. So eerily enough, these platforms, it's an attention economy. And so they generally want you to be addicted to the platform. So Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, X, whatever. Meanwhile, then you have Elon Musk.
TikTok.
Yeah, TikTok. So these are deeply structural relationships to your brain, dopamine, serotonin, and other things that are triggered by the platforms. And it's fascinating to see how the algorithms are tweaked to make sure that you are on those platforms. So your brain has developed a deep structural relationship. In fact, there was a really good article recently, I believe it was in New Yorker, where a lot of engineers and people who make the codes that drive these platforms won't let their kids get on these platforms. So their brains are being conditioned, or our brains, by our phones and the various digital media around us. And so there's a psychedelic element to that as well.
Going back into the history, if you, you know, and Doug, you actually probably know more about this ultimately than the rest of us here. So I'm going to jump into your asking you this. But if you look at that, what was going on back in the 60s in Silicon Valley-ish area, the Ken Kesey world intersecting with the Douglas Engelbart world, and there was a lot of play going on with psychedelics. And psychedelics and play really did inspire the original development of many of the tools that we...
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
That really formed the foundation of the digital universe that we are now inhabiting. But it somehow didn't stick. It's like the play got pushed to the side.
Yeah,
in a way.
I mean, I love to mythologize that the net and psychedelics started with like Ken Kesey and Pranksters and John Barlow and Howard Rheingold and The Well and Stuart Brand and all that. But both psychedelics and digital technology really came, at least to America, through the military. And there was this moment where, oh my God, swords to plowshares, right? We're going to take these drugs that were created, you know, and used in MK Ultra, and these technologies that were here to, you know, help have a decentralized command and control structure during a nuclear war. And now we got them. We deadheads are going to play with them, and we're going to do it. And it felt like we were the originals, but we kind of weren't. And not to sound pessimistic, but I feel like some of the original qualities of these tools, particularly synthetic psychedelics, and certainly digital technology, some of the original qualities are manifesting themselves again. You know, that these are tools of surveillance and control. These are, every video game you play is still based on war simulations from before, and some of those qualities end up coming back out again. Plus, what you're talking about before, that the digital tech titan guys are programming their platforms with their sensibility, even when they're not just doing it to be mean to us and to control us. It's just their way of seeing the world ends up becoming our way of seeing the world because we take the platforms for granted. A child who's raised in a world where TikTok is how you communicate, they're not thinking of it as a social network. It just is. It becomes a condition of nature. So it's tricky, but yes, the original late 80s, early 90s, yay, we were reading the Gaia hypothesis. We were going to wire up the human brain into the new collective consciousness of the planet and do all that, you know, Mondo 2000 and fantasy role-playing games and smart drugs and psychedelic drugs and rave and new physics and chaos math and Ralph Abraham and Terrence McKenna, Rupert Sheldrake and morphogeneticism. It was all part of the same thing. We were going to play, and then wire magazine and came along and said, no, this is actually a business opportunity. And we pivoted the net to the thing that we have today. And partly because we didn't realize, I think, and I'm only coming to this now, we didn't realize the political value of what we were doing, that shift in power. We were throwing a rave in a parking lot, not realizing, oh, we're reclaiming space for a public activity. This is a political act. It's not just play, you know, and we lost those 60s values in the 90s intentionally. We didn't want to be social justice warriors. We didn't want to fight that. We didn't wanted to have no agenda, because that's where the 60s went wrong. They had an agenda and they all sold out. We're going to have no agenda and just find the aliens. And that one didn't work.
Yeah, well, I mean, eerily enough, Doug, I mean, the fun part about that 90s moment, I was DJing, I used to DJ Burning Man, for example, and I was going to, I mean, Larry Harvey, I curated an event with The Economist magazine a while ago where I had Larry before he passed away. We did a debate about psychedelic economics, because economics is, and market forces are based on perception. So if markets are being viewed as going up, there's this kind of stochastic approach, you know. And these days, a lot of people are calling like Trump a stochastic terrorist, because what it'll do is algorithmically sort of scattershot enough people to be radicalized on social media that there's these small lone wolf sparks that start popping up. But so too with market forces and the market force of consciousness. So the pun here is, like, if you look at, I think at least the science part of it, there's an overlap with both quantum physics, mainly from stuff like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, the idea of perception itself engaging with the mechanism of the universe around us. Mm-hmm. So a lot of billionaires are now in this theory, like Elon Musk loves this, are we in a simulation? Are we, as the idea of humans existing in a data continuum, that all of our, you know, but the West has always had this problem with the body. You know, it's like Cartesian, daemon, you know, that cogito ergo sum. Eerily enough, in other cultures that had psychedelics, like in West Africa, there's the Iboga tribe, and there's a psychedelic called Ibogaine. There's a really good documentary, Lucy Walker, hers is coming out a little bit. It was on Netflix.
It's the Bwiti tribe.
Yeah, the Bwiti.
Bwiti in Africa, yeah.
Yeah, it's
Gabon.
West Africa, Gabon. And so eerily
enough,
drug
is Ibogaine.
And so there's other approaches, but the West has had this crisis of the body versus the mind, you know, so the dualism. Those are things that intrigue me. Why? Like, why is there this sort of rational approach to psychedelic culture? So Immanuel Kant is not someone I'd ever want to trip with. You know, it's just putting that out there.
I wouldn't want to trip with Francis Bacon either. Any of these dudes. They were so afraid of nature and the body. Yeah, they were so afraid of nature and body and life. The quote I always bring up from Francis Bacon when he was trying to sell the idea of empirical science. He said, "Empirical science will let us take nature by the forelock, hold her down, and submit her to our will." Right. So that's the tradition of science, right? This bizarre rape fantasy. Right. And that's, you know, where do you go? Where there's the lineage, right, from there through Gates to Musk. Right. It's again, it's about control and, right, getting out of the body. And you would think someone does psychedelics and they're going to have that experience that we all had on psychedelics. But you give psychedelics to a tech bro and they seem to have a fundamentally different experience, right? They come back, maybe they were 10 seconds, I'm gonna save the world by coming up with an analog of this psychedelic, patenting it, and making it the only legal, you know, my new startup.
I just want to remind the room that some of us feel strongly that cannabis is a psychedelic. And one of the things I love about cannabis, and there are so many things, is that I feel very embodied. If I have a puff or two, one of the first things I notice is, my posture. And, you know, I feel very embodied immediately. And I just want to remind everyone here, you know, we live in New York now, where you can avail yourself of this very available psychedelic drug, the people's psychedelic.
It's true. I inhaled a bit on my way here on the sidewalk just from some lovely young woman who was exhaling at that very moment. So given the challenge that maybe certain tech bros are having around understanding maybe the finer aspects of the psychedelic experience, I sent you guys an email the other day. I grabbed a post from a chat list that I'm on announcing a psychedelic guide GPT. Essentially an AI integration specialist.
How do you feel about that?
Julie.
How does that make you feel?
How does that make you feel, Julie?
Where do you feel that in your body? What does that make you think of? And how do you feel about that? But I will tell you something. I mean, I years and years ago, I mean, I think I was an undergrad. So it's like in the 80s, 90s, I was reading about AI and like making an AI therapist. And one thing that we've known for like 30 or 40 years, even if you know it's AI, you still like treat them like your therapist and you start opening up and talking to them. Even if you know it's a robot, you are telling it about, you know, what you dreamt last night in your childhood.
Yeah.
I don't think I am, but people do.
Yeah, but there's workbooks, you know. You could take The Way of the Artist or something and Course in Miracle, whatever. You can have a great experience with something. You don't have to think of it as a, you mean, you're not going to do transference, I wouldn't think, but maybe you do.
Maybe you want to marry the robot.
But you know what's so weird, though, about what you're saying is that we live in this world of disembodied and very coercive forces. So the guy who invented the thumbs up like on Facebook, for example, or the person who invented the red pin drop on Google Maps, there's a specific logic to the legible landscape. And so, eerily enough, the way we think about moving through both these experiences we're talking about with psychedelics and data, to me, have a interesting overlap. But the problem right now is the Western model. I really feel like this notion of rationality is leading us straight towards extinction. And I'm intrigued by the post-rational. How do we get this sort of primal urge of the, I think the best part of the 60s was getting people to rethink rationalism and rethink our relationship to the body and to the coercive politics around us. And so the politics of our time is this tension. I mean, that's what I think whenever I watch, I just saw because the New Hampshire primaries and stuff, you know, it was like a hillbilly Nuremberg rally, you know, this kind of the sense of the way that these primal, I think that Trump represents the worst of certain aspects of contemporary society, but at the same time, he gives people permission to be their worst. And again, it's what you call the sort of a structure of permissions. And people are trying to grapple with this stuff. Meanwhile, we're being bombarded, overwhelmed, and everything. We're the most medicated society in human history. So how do we grapple with these things? Because there's a multi-billion dollar industry at every part of this question facing us right now.
Yeah, but the healthy part of Trump or Trumpism.
Is there such a thing?
Yeah. the healthy urge underlying it is, you know, we live in a society that we realized this when we did the WTO protests in Seattle. We're in a globalist, abstracted society where huge systems and technocrats and organizations that we don't even know seem to be running a giant, brittle global supply chain that disconnects us from the places we live and who we are and how we feel. And in Trumpism, you see 10,000 or 20,000 people gather with their bodies in a shared giant evil rave, right? Together, talking about how we've been dispossessed, right? My family's dug coal out of this ground for four generations. Now, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama want me to make friggin' deep state, want me to make friggin' solar panels that I don't understand for some Chinese company in a global supply chain. What is this? right? So nationalism and localism, I mean, as a Jew, I understand, you know, nationalism and localism, and because we always used to go to other places and go, okay, your gods are cool, you know, and just try to get along with them. Say, we do something different. We're abstract. You know, one god, it's okay. Don't worry about it. We're just here. It's okay. But so I recognize it, but there's a problem with denying people their feet on the ground, their bodies in space, their lived communities and their lived physical local experience. And the digital quality has dovetailed with global neoliberalism to make us feel alienated from our own lives. And Trumpism is the reaction, I think, or is partly the reaction to that.
So given that,
how can we take more psychedelics to fix it?
Well, that's not a bad question. That wasn't mine. I'm wondering about the interest in psychedelics at Davos.
Yeah.
Are they tripping at Davos?
Oh, you're not paying attention.
Yeah,
I want to go. I like to ski. I like to ski. If anyone could get me to Davos, I'd like to go there. Yeah.
Well, they had a track.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, it's a pharmacological market force. So, amusingly enough, the pharmaceutical industry at every level is trying to figure out new markets. I mean, one could argue, for example, the pandemic with mRNA technology, the spinoffs from that are going to be cancer treatments. There's going to be all sorts of really amazing things coming out of. I'm very pro-vaccine, but at the same time, they need new markets. So, the psychedelic market. And the legalization.
I have to interrupt you here because it's actually not true.
Wait, which one?
The idea that the pharmaceutical industry is desperately looking to expand their potential markets and entering psychedelics. That is really not how it's happening. What's going on right now are some extraordinarily, how should I put it, you know, dedicated psychedelics people looking for a way to justify the seduction of the pharmaceutical industry into the potential of creating psychedelics using a pharmaceutical model, which frankly right now is far from a certain thing, from what I can tell. There are two companies that are right now moving towards the possibility of FDA approval for a psychedelic medicine within the next 2 to 3 years. Right. They are not deep-pocketed.
It's terrible business, though. It's like I do a good assisted mushroom therapy session twice. There goes my Lexapro. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like, seriously, you know, we were I was really depressed this summer. I did psychedelics with these people. It was like, dang. And that was you could grow that in a Tupperware for $4.
Yeah. That's real. And I think that people in the pharmaceutical industry maybe
are not... They're scared shitless of that.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they're scared shitless. They're not doing very much about it one way or the other at the moment. Julie, you're probably closer to this than I am.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is a lot going on in the psychedelic sector. And I mean, I know I do some kind of freelance consulting as a psychiatrist, and I get pinged quite a bit. Big Pharma does want to know what's going on, and they
at this point they're starting to ask.
But I think what they're, you know, MDMA that you take 2 or 3 times in your lifetime is not going to make anybody any money. That there, the money is more in the therapy. Right. Microdosing because you're taking it regularly, I think, may have more money. I think that people are looking at psychedelics for neurological illnesses and traumatic brain injury, and then that would be probably chronic, not once. Right. It would probably be more consistent, and so I think there is some. I mean, Otsuka just. But there are definitely pharmaceutical companies that are buying in to what's happening, at least a little.
There are about a half dozen that have begun to put some money into psychedelic companies over the last year.
More money is going into the non-hallucinogenic psychedelics that, you know, the plasticogens, that name is not going to stickogen to me. But it's this idea that there are some substances that can induce neuroplasticity so that you can do a little bit of sort of, in quotes, rewiring, recircuitry, you know, this idea of play and plasticity are really connected, you know, that you can kind of move outside the boundaries and wiggle things around. And one of the reasons why psychedelics are, why so many people are looking to them therapeutically is that they work transdiagnostically. I mean, one of the ways I think about it is just like a spectrum of rigidity and flexibility. And we see cognitive rigidity and obsessive compulsive disorder. You see it in like a very depressive way of thinking. You know, nothing ever works out for me. It's very rigid thinking. OCD is a great example, right? Very rigid. If I count to 8, if I turn it this way, then I'll be safe. And addiction is a lot of rigidity too. It's like, if I take this drug, if I drink this, if I do this, then I'll feel good, then I'll feel better. It's this very rigid way of thinking. And the psychedelics introduce a little bit of like, what if that's not the case? And what if we just have a little wiggle room and it doesn't always have to be this way? And so that's why I think they're transdiagnostic.
Well, they're looking specifically for physiological changes without a tripping experience for many of those medicines.
Right, especially like let's say you're someone who just had a stroke and you really need neuroplasticity badly because half your brain needs to kind of be rerouted the other way around. You're not going to want to trip every day or every 3 days. You know, you're going to want, I mean, right. There is going to be, this debate comes up all the time. And I'm like, it's not either or. You know, there are people who the trip is the point and the visions and the ideas and the epiphanies and the crying and the laughing and the feeling like everything's connected. And like, that's the point for some people. But for other people who are brain injured, that's not what they're looking for.
Right. So just to justify the way that I cut off Paul before.
You don't need to justify yourself to me.
Oh, well, that's the kind of relationship off. We have, and
just,
I appreciate
just
that.
Just in cutting off Paul, I mean.
But just to say,
ooh, I got two for there.
That there is yet to be seen a strong desire by the pharmaceutical industry to find a way to help people trip through the medical establishment. That is not yet, at least, happening. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, the illicit markets of like fentanyl, the idea that people are facing a psychological epidemic of wanting to almost be a simulation of death. That's my motto for why fentanyl is so popular. It's like numbing, it's withdrawal, it's a spiritual sort of devastation that people are just going into a shopping mall and just feeling like the whole world is dead. But at the same time, these corporations are always trying to figure out new patents, new molecules, new formulas, and then just tweak it a little bit, and then they'll, kind of patent it and charge a fortune for it. Same with diabetic pills, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on. One could argue even the rise of gummy vitamins right now is a huge market or something. So I do feel that we're at a crossroads where people are trying to figure out at every level how to market and then figure out. The legalization process in America is a mess. Weed, mushrooms, you name it. But the illicit markets are where these kind of huge undercurrents of finance are going. And I think it's going to, it's like prohibition in the middle of the 1920s. If you make something illegal, people will find a way. And that's the problem.
It's interesting that for part of the conversation, I felt like almost like we were taking on the capitalism's requirement to figure out, well, okay, so how can these things also make money? It's sort of the tech bro thing. It's like, oh, I came up with a great app and it's a cool thing, but how can it also make $1 billion? Right. And I figured out a way to do carbon capture, but how can it also make $1 billion? So we've got, the psychedelics are working, but how can they also make $1 billion? It's like, well, what if they can't? What if they're degrowth-ish? What if they make people real? I don't have to work as hard, or I don't want to work as hard, or I'm stuck. What if psychedelics, which is what I think they realized in the 60s, are anti-capitalist, finally? Yeah.
What if?
Well, then the psychedelic community will be oppressed.
Are you expecting?
We are oppressed. We have been all along. I mean, and now that we're finally coming up with, maybe you can get a little more utility value out of people, because if depressed people or drunkards or whatever will stop drinking so much, It's like, maybe we'll throw you a couple of little pennies here.
I mean, think how much damage alcohol does to everyone, pretty much every, yep. If you think about it, to compare the psychological impact of alcohol on our civilization is incredible. I mean, amounts of death, total destruction, devastation of your body. Meanwhile, there's far more healthier things that are illegal because of the way that we deal with like this prohibition mentality.
Healthy things don't help the market in the short term.
Right.
Right. If you've got a liver transplant because of your alcoholism, that goes right to the GDP.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to try to maneuver this back into the realm of computers. We'll get there in a second. Okay. So artificial intelligence. Okay. It's an interesting phrase, I think. The more psychedelics I do, the less I'm convinced that computers can ever be intelligent. And I'm wondering how psychedelic perspective could maybe help to recast a bit of the AI mania that we're now currently living through. And should I keep
to go first?
Should I keep going with this? Or?
I'm not going to interrupt you now, Paul.
It's a dialectic, man. Okay, well, considering I've passed the mic here, we really, really, really need to rethink this notion that AI and various software are products of human intelligence. And when I say that, it's from the viewpoint of it's all math. If you really think about it, it's just math. I'm fascinated with, say, for example, the debate between Newton and Leibniz from a couple centuries ago. I usually would go with the Germans on this one. I think, you know, Leibniz was the brilliant one. Newton, he did split light beams and made rainbows, but that, you know, calculus, all sorts of other things that go into the way we think about our digital current moment. The AI is just math. But the problem is it's at such a massive scale that people are there. If you say the term large language model, you're essentially looking at natural language put through incredible amounts of comparative frames of reference simultaneously. Like if I said, what's the best route to Fifth Avenue and 22nd Street? But if I just told you go to Fifth, turn left, that's simple. But the computer might give you an optimized route because it's compared tens of thousands of routes in a matter of a microsecond. So it's more the scale and speed. It's just humans doing our thing, but with a bicycle. You know, that's kind of my motto. I don't really view AI as the threat. It's an extension of us, and it's a tool.
When I put on my psychedelic glasses, or my psychedelic filters, not filters, unfilters, I get two main things from AI. First is the push towards reverting to the mean. You know, AIs work by finding the most probable solution, the most probable next word, the most probable picture. So it's taking human novelty and moving in the opposite direction, right? Towards the mean, averaging down. It's statistical averages, which is to me anti-life. The second thing I get when I think about AI in a psychedelic context is a very occult vibe. I feel like that AI is almost a form of sigil magic in which we launch an entity that is designed to convince Julie of something by any means necessary, right? So we're going to launch an AI algorithm to get her to buy something any way it can.
I already bought it.
Usually by triggering her and learning about her and then triggering her deepest, darkest fears in order to activate her and then sharing it with all the other ones so they can do it to their people, which to me is like coding and launching demons. Literally little demons to arrest us. So that's kind of dark. But yeah. But when I'm tripping, that's what AIs
demon
feel like. Yeah, come take me, demon.
Oh no.
I don't know. When I've done psychedelics, I think of infinity. It's something I'm fascinated with infinity. In fact, there's a great parable which I love to bring up to audiences like this. Two of my favorite human beings of the 20th century, Albert Einstein and Rabindranath Tagore. Rabindranath Tagore, if you're not from South Asia, he's the first Indian poet to win the Nobel Prize. So they're backstage, Einstein getting a Nobel Prize for this thing called the General Theory of Relativity. And so you have these two guys, one with crazy hair, the other with a crazy beard. And Einstein, when he was about to get the award, he would get nervous. And he was a very talented violinist. So he would pace and he would play stuff like violin interpretations of Bach's Goldberg variations. So the Indian gentleman looks at him and says, you know, your Western music's all fucked up because you guys didn't have zero. You got to come to India. Amusing enough, Einstein pauses for a second. And he says, you're right. And I love the fact that the Western model, for example, thousands of years of music tuning systems without zero. The Greeks and Romans, you had to go to India. Even bringing Arabic numerals to the West was controversial. The Pope tried to ban zero. There was a Fibonacci, it's called the Libra Abaci, the number Arabic numerals were controversial. So the Western tuning systems, think of it as when you go to a rave, and you talk about raves a lot, you're basically hearing minor chord, major chord, like dun, 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 stuff like that. And it's still kind of going to the Greco-Roman model of tuning. Now, where am I going with AI with this? The fun part about it, if you have a system that wasn't even aware that it was missing something, then you would just continue on that path without the additional input or insight or overview. Then you meet an amazing Indian poet who says, by the way, your whole system's fucked up because you didn't have zero. And so I love that as a paradox of our time. So they became good friends and wrote a book together called On the Nature of Reality. You have one of the world's leading physicists and one of the world's leading poets talking about the poetics of physics. And it's a really cool book if you ever have a long flight. But AI is that kind of statistical hallucination. And it's the sensibility is that we have this incredible tool, mathematics, science, physics, that is already surreal enough. I mean, the universe itself is insane. It's totally wild. And so whenever you sit and take whatever substance that disintermediates you from the surroundings, that's okay. I think it's a beautiful thing. The problem with the Western model, again, I keep sort of harping on the West, but other cultures took it in different ways. And I find it, you know, these days I'm calling it psychedelic colonialism, where all these people are going to Peru and they're going to their, you know, ayahuasca or whatever, which is cool. Again, you know, it's a conversation. But maybe we need to update our rituals. Maybe we need to update our forms of engaging the world around us, and just this provocation there. Anyway, that's my kind of view of AI.
I'm almost following you.
It's complicated. There we go. It's complicated.
What's zero?
What?
Exactly.
Right. I mean, one of the interesting uses of language that in the AI world that has emerged in the last year, I think it was word of the year Webster's or something like that, was the idea that artificial intelligence computers can hallucinate.
They can't.
Right.
They can say weird stuff.
Right.
Well, they can say stuff that's wrong. I mean, right. They can make mistakes. And I found that a really interesting use of the word hallucination. A lot of folks in the psychedelic world actually have very deliberately stopped using the word hallucinogen to describe a psychedelic because hallucinogen suggests that what you're seeing isn't there, that it's not real.
Right. It's suggesting that this feeling of like love being the answer and that we're all connected and we're all one and we're so small in the universe, like that's not a hallucination to me. So I definitely don't use the word hallucinogen. That's one of the ways I know if I've been misquoted in the press, because I don't use the word hallucinogen. So, because I don't think it is a hallucination. It's like, you know, and you were saying like defilter, you know, I think, and who is the mescaline? Thank you. Huxley. Thanks, Jeremy. You know, Huxley talked about that you're just, the mescaline allows you to see the world as it really is. And I think neurologically, physiologically, it is that you're the gatekeeper and the thing that decides what you see and what you don't see is offline. So I don't think it's a hallucinogen, and I definitely don't. I care about nomenclature. Like, I don't like to call cannabis marijuana, and I don't like to call psychedelics hallucinogens. Mm. That's all.
So can a deep fake be psychedelic?
100%.
Can a deep fake be psychedelic?
Yeah.
Be mind manifesting? Can a deep fake be mind manifesting? Is that the question?
I think everything is psychedelic right now because the world has become this kind of digital phantasmagoria. We're at this crossroads of George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World remixed. You know,
so what does psychedelics mean to you? Psychedelic, what does it mean to you?
It means you have done an interior journey that's been triggered by an interaction with whatever substance. I drink reishi tea, for example. That's my morning thing with a little dash of chaga. And that gets me moving instead of coffee. But there's a molecular interaction that goes on that triggers all sorts of things. But then I check my email and that's a fucking different email, you know, brain chemistry going. And the fun part about all of this is that neuroplasticity is part of how this all works. So hallucination is just, to me at least, it's a framing of things. It's how we frame. I mean, African-American walking down a street in America is a fucking hallucination because we weren't not even considered a human being for a while. The 14th Amendment is great. I love it. But they turned, by the way, into corporations. I don't know if anyone is into how corporations came into existence, but it was because of the Civil War. And they were like, oh, yeah, these people that we used to call 3/5 of a human being, we need to make an amendment. But by the way, somebody slipped in some language that said, oh, by the way, corporations are people, too. If you just look it up. And next thing you know, we have corporate personhood. And then you have the fucking Supreme Court, Citizens United, giving money as free speech. So that's a fucking hallucination. There you go.
I wish it were a hallucination.
Yeah, if only it were a hallucination. Yeah, so it's interesting because my relationship to working with psychedelics has ultimately helped me see fewer hallucinations, I think, in the kind of the defiltering that Doug was referring to. And so I'm wondering whether there's a kind of divergent approach to psychedelics that's sort of emerging in the current moment, where there's a, some folks see it more as like, whoa, everything is just moving so fast and flowing, and I'm getting all kinds of interesting, wild, like juxtapositions and visuals I never saw before. And this is kind of disorienting, but wow. And maybe for others, and maybe this is more sort of in the plant medicine world, kind of this idea that when you do psychedelics, you're grounding yourself in a way. You're connecting more to the earth. You're connecting more to your body. You're having more of a sense of connection to everything, where things actually make more sense, strangely. Julie's nodding as if I might even
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things that psychedelics can reliably do is everything is infused with meaning. Everything seems like it's the right thing, you know, and you've just figured it out. And, you know, you talked about like in the 50s and 60s, lots of people were tripping and everybody thought they had the answer and this is great. And then, you know, it happens again with MDMA and like the, you know, 80s or 90s, like, you know, there's every generation comes back to the same drugs thinking that they're amazing and they're going to change the world. And it's just like, maybe we're getting a little closer to them actually being available and being useful, because it's so important to have utility.
It's also, I mean, what I have a feeling, I don't have evidence for it, but that what psychedelics are might change depending on where the human organism is at. You know, so for me, in the last couple of years, psychedelics has been so much about becoming capable of metabolizing the pain and trauma that so many people are going through. I can't do psychedelics now and not, I really got to breathe. I look at the faces. I mean, but then that's me. And I'm sure other people could do psychedelics right now and say, oh, you know, we're in a SimCity universe and now I've got the new blockchain that's going to solve that. You know, maybe. But I feel like that they are, again, the set and setting in which we live is cultural. It's civilizational. We are living in a world at the edge, at the precipice of, you know, many potential. I hope I'm not scaring anyone, but there's like a lot of things that can happen really bad. And I think we're aware of that when we're tripping now, maybe more than we were, you know, in the late 60s when it seemed like, oh, we're going to have peace, love, and change, you know, fight the war and, you know, reach something.
Well, you know, ignorance is bliss. I mean, back in the 60s, like, you know, you had some sense of what was going on in Vietnam or something, but you didn't, like, now, you know, in McLuhan would say that, like, our nervous system is on the outside of our body. Like, you know, I can look at my phone and feel the pain of a woman in whatever country who is holding a dead baby. And I'm like, oh my God, it's so terrible. But it's, I feel it. I feel it like it's happening to me and it's terrible. It's happening to me and it's halfway across the world. And I don't think it's great to know everything everywhere all at once that's happening, especially when there's really scary bad news that you can't do anything about. I mean, the whole, you know, having no control over things that scare you is a setup for depression. It's a setup for panic disorder. I mean, you know, I have job security forever now because of the way we're living. Like, you know, I don't have to advertise. People are very anxious. And there's, you know, ever since COVID also, there's a lot more self-soothing going on. And part of the way that we soothe ourselves, this is my last book, Good Chemistry, is all about sort of healthy ways and unhealthy ways to soothe yourself. And, you know, the scrolling... There's a quote that I love, which is, you can never get enough of something that almost works. What we need is genuine connection and feeling held and feeling safe. And what we get is this sort of a synthetic approximation of a community. And if I am altered or tripping, I don't want to be anywhere near my phone or my computer. I want to be out in nature or just... it's too much knowing everything that's happening everywhere.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that because, like, one of the phrases you used was everything, everywhere, all at once, which was one of my favorite films of the last couple of years. But if you just close your eyes for a second, listen to the hum of the room around you. There's an electric hum. There's wind going. The hum is probably in B flat. The wind going is in A sharp. Anybody who knows music, you just go up or down a couple
A-sharp
octaves.
A sharp and B flat.
Yeah.
Almost the same.
They're the same thing.
I know. Okay. You listen to the electric hum. So the American electrical system is at 110 volts. Europe's on 220. So amusing enough, if you walk down a street in most major cities, you'll hear that electric hum.
The 60 hertz.
Yeah, the hertz. And so America has so much electricity everywhere. think about all of the wires humming. And so when I walk through a street, I think of all of these kind of experiential but science-based experiences that let you grasp the physicality of the moment. And the eerie thing is, science, the arts, these are all things that are giving us better portraits of what it means to be human. And that's where the problem, Julie is riffing on this. I mean, when you talk about our time, everyone is so, how should I put this? There's a market for getting depression and anxiety and trauma into pharmacological solutions. So if you're depressed, here's a pill. If you're happy, you don't want to be happy. If you don't want to think, here's a pill. If you want this, there's a sensation that we can give you. There's a market. Here you go. So how do we figure out these provocations to make a better sense of being a citizen and a person in the 21st century? This is something I'm grappling with right now because we're in this era of like incandescent cynicism. The other day, a friend of mine sent me an article about the Israeli troops are using AI for targeting. And they have this series of AI analysis of the different streets in Gaza and the tunnels. And the tunnels reminded me of all these, the philosopher Deleuze and Guattari, they call it rhizomes. You know, they're these kind of network systems. And it's incredible to see this sheer volume of potential of our time. We're at the wildest moment in human history. If you really think about it, this is an incredible experience. The humans, we've only had this structure in a couple thousand years. And beyond that, a couple hundred thousand years ago, a human being would walk into Times Square and be like, this is an incredible science fictional. They wouldn't even know what to make of it, except for the screens, the projections, the noise, the light. And these are things that I think your average person right now, I feel like we're in the science fictional realm at this point. Don't forget Blade Runner was set in the year 2020. I always chuckle about that. Where are spaceships? Why aren't we going further out?
It's interesting. This moment, I mean, sitting here with you in this space at this moment reminds me of similar spaces with similar sensibilities in 1990, 1991, except instead of it being about psychedelics, it was about not even the internet, it was about digital technology. We've got this tool, we're going to be able to connect people, we're going to do stuff. It was so, it was hopeful and it was possible, and got pivoted into something very, very different. I think that psychedelics are at least as powerful as the internet. And I feel like we're in a similar moment, yet I don't feel empowered through my experience of what happened before to tell people how to prevent that from happening now. And I would love it if in the rest of the time we have, we figured out how to do that.
That actually was my next question.
Okay. Good, then let's answer it.
Okay. So what might the emerging psychedelics industry learn from the mistakes of Silicon Valley? This was actually your question, Doug.
Not everything is compatible with exponential market growth, that exponential growth is not nature. It's the only things that grow exponentially in nature either do it for a very brief period of time or kill their host.
Right.
So if we want either AI or algorithms or psychedelics to grow exponentially, it's the end of us.
I mean, you know, so related to that, what occurred to me was how, like, as you said, in that digital moment of the 90s, things just went so askew and we ended up with Facebook and all of this kind of extraordinarily, this concentration of access to information and communications through just a handful of portals that were just way out of control in terms of what the reach that they had and how out of alignment that was with the original intentions of some of the innovators like a Douglas Engelbart and people who were really sort of first were coming up with these tools and were building them in a way that were originally intended to do things that would have made that kind of concentration of power very difficult, but they got bypassed.
Yeah, I would say the other thing to learn is very early in the computer revolution, we distanced the programmer from the user. In the early 90s, when you played with the computer, you were programming the computer. And then over time, in the Mac, God bless Steve, but with the Mac and other operating systems, we pushed the user further and further away from what was actually going on. So, I mean, the easiest way to maintain to fight monopoly in a psychedelic era is for everyone to grow their own. I mean, right. If it's everywhere, then they can't control it quite.
I think that's definitely a big part of it. The other thing that I would add is an awareness that we don't need to rush into the next big thing immediately. It could take a little longer. There was no reason in the world why digital communications had to move so fast into Facebook, and other than a profit motive.
Right.
And there was a profit motive, and also there was a kind of, there was a cultural sense of this, like, proving itself to people as something that's valuable because it was making people money, as opposed to people thinking through, oh, there's a social value here. Let's understand the social value. With psychedelics, I sometimes wonder if we're kind of going through a similar moment, whether there's enough attention being paid to the social positive aspects of healthy psychedelic use and culture outside of a, you know, what is, you know, essentially a medical model, which is where much of the conversation is now being driven.
Sure. You know, this is where you get that Steven Pinker moment, or like Voltaire, where it says the, you know, Pangloss was this character who said it's the best of all possible worlds. And Steven Pinker, if you haven't read, he's a Harvard professor, he feels that violence is decreasing, everything's great, and we're comparatively speaking, he always has a statistical relativism going. And I chuckle over this because the problem of our time is comparative frames of reference, and I think that people, or lack thereof. And I think the most powerful tool psychedelics give us is that sense of intuitive comparativeness. And if you think about it, the internet, again, we can debate this issue, but it mostly comes out of what you call ARPANET, which was a military communications tool. Some people feel that it was not fully purposed for America to be able to communicate if there was a nuclear war. Then if you have Sir Tim Berners-Lee, I always chuckle about this because I got commissioned to do a symphony celebrating the 50th anniversary of the internet. And people are like, the internet's 50 years old. And he's like, yeah, it's 1969 to 2019. Yes, that's 50 years. And then the web, which is a different thing, was created in CERN, Switzerland, which is a sort of a super collider particle accelerator that generated so much data that they needed to index. And so that's where Sir Tim Berners-Lee came up with what you call HTML, hypertext markup language. So amusingly enough, the two different things, the internet is the architecture. One could argue the web is the structures that we use to cover the architecture. Like it's like the bones of the building versus the actual metastructure. And so these are things where Sir Tim Berners-Lee was trying to grapple with indexing physics and thinking about how to be able to create the web as a place of open information. It wouldn't have been able to exist without free government grants, because it was made in a university, it was made as an open source initiative.
No, you could go even further.
Yeah.
It couldn't have been created without a generation of innovations by people like Douglas Engelbart and people in his lab in Stanford at SRI in the 60s.
And it wasn't from the private sector.
It was definitely public sector money. Some was military, some was NASA. But also, they put all of their innovations into the public domain, including the mouse, hyperlinks, overlapping windows on a screen, the idea that you could actually teleconferencing, the idea that you could have network communications through different personal computers that have interlocking systems, symbol systems that allowed for all kinds of shared manipulation of the symbols, cut, copy, paste. I mean, you can go on and on and on with how much was developed.
Free and open.
They decided deliberately to make that free and open because they wanted it to be widely adopted. And at the same time, though, they also, many of those people in that original group, understood the potential of essentially fake news, bad information being transferred through the network. And they built in systems in order to allow the tracing of posts and information that was being shared back to its original source so that things could be verified. And Tim Berners-Lee left that part out. Okay.
Well, it's because two-way. This was, you know, this was Ted Nelson for Xanadu. He wanted two-way linking, but right. It was too hard to do at that. It wasn't until Pretty Good Privacy came out, you know, PGP, Pretty Good Privacy, that we actually figured out how to do a reliable two-way linking thing.
No, they wanted to do the net.
They didn't know how to do it at the time.
Engelbart had it working on his online system in the 70s.
He did.
I saw it. He showed it to me.
And they wouldn't deploy it.
Tim Berners-Lee decided it was too complicated for people to use.
Ah, motherfucker. Right.
And it's the same way that Steve Jobs felt that it was really important for people to be able to pick up a computer, laptop, or whatever it was back in those days, and just start using it without any training. And he dropped two buttons off of the mouse. Right. And originally had three buttons. And Doug Engelbart never spoke to him again after that because he said, my God, what you're doing is you're dumbing everything down to the point where nobody needs to know anything in order to use these tools.
Well, you can control click.
Right. And then, yeah, well,
but
exactly.
But Ken, so the beauty of that is that the open source approach to culture, the arts, and life itself, to me at least, is one of evolution's greatest gifts. The free exchange of information, the free exchange of cultural tropes, you name it. And the walled garden approach, which is our main corporate mechanism right now, has reduced innovation. At least that's my take on it. Napster was, amusingly enough, a free and open system. And then Steve Jobs hired several of the same engineers in this thing called iTunes. You know, I remember when the first iPods came out, Napster had been burdened with all these huge lawsuits. Same thing happened with over and over, the open version versus the walled garden, open version, walled garden. Even the operating system that, you know, you're talking about the symbols, he appropriated from Xerox PARC.
But we can't use truly...
I'm talking about Steve Jobs saying from Xerox.
You can't use truly open systems until we arrest capitalism, though, right? So if I'm a musician, at a certain point, I want to be credited and paid for the IP of the music I've written. Now, I understand in an ideal world, we're more like in Bali, right? Where everyone just plays music for each other. Everybody's an artist, you know, but we're not there. So in the end, it's not the technology's problem. It's the economic model's problem.
And on that note, maybe we should open this up to some questions from the folks in the audience. There was a guy. Yeah, there's somebody back there with his hand up a while ago. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for this just extraordinary exchange and opportunity. Thank you, Paul, for your polymath finger on so many pulses and the way you, the way you deliver it. And Doug, I was going to say your closeted anarchism, but you're not closeted. It's very, it's very clear and it's invigorating. And Julie, maybe I'll direct my comment to you as a physician. And as someone that's been treating patients for a long time and had my own first experience with altered states of consciousness in 1971 at Amherst College, and then was at Stanford doing biochemistry, working on neurotransmitters, went to Harvard Medical School. And at Harvard, I was just a few years behind Andrew Weil, okay, and Mark Vonnegut. And that's an example where some of the comments about the pharmaceutical industry, and it's very easy to paint in bold colors or black and white. And you know, you understand this, just listening to what you're saying. Mark Vonnegut, Eden Express, his autobiography, without lithium, was dead. Was just dead. Lithium saved that man. But the therapeutic index is very narrow. Right. And acute kidney failure happens all the time. So there has to be good follow-up in levels. Similarly with Andrew Weil, he went on to the Institute of Noetic Studies, did some of the original work in the Amazon on the plants, and talked about this in 1972 in The Natural Mind, and said, without the proper context, things can get out of control. And that's my question to all of you. Or in the technology area, you're right about the communications. When I was at Stanford, Scott McNeely and Bill Joy had Sun Microsystems. Sun is Stanford University Network. It's not the Sun. It's Stanford University Network. And packetized data transfers, all of that work was being done in Silicon Valley. But they thought only scientific people would use it. So it was a narrow business model. And ultimately, what they went out of business, and Apple and Microsoft and others took it over. The context is always so important. Talking about the pharmaceutical industry, and I work with the pharmaceutical industry. I'm on a regular communication with Albert Bourla at Pfizer, and I've worked with Paul Vagelos at Merck. these companies, they want to find solutions. And it isn't just left-wing progressive crazies out there. Peter Thiel is probably putting more money into this than anyone else. And he's as right-wing in his own little world, venture capital. They don't know how to do it. They don't know whether it's going to be ketamine. They don't know what MDMA, to me, is the miracle here. But it's so easy to go off track with this stuff. And, you know, you look around this room, pretty homogeneous room. I would bet that the backgrounds here are pretty similar, but you start to bring some of these into other markets or other communities. The percentage of cannabinoids now in the stuff that you can get in these stores, it's not 2 or 3% for a $5 lid when in 1968 or 69 in high school. It's 25 or 30%. And you know this, they're coming into the ER in acute psychotic break. So how do you control this?
I don't really know that. Some of that I agree with and some of that I don't agree with. Yeah, I worked at Bellevue in the psychiatric emergency room for 9 years. Every Saturday night and Sunday night for 9 years, I worked at Bellevue. I never once saw anybody with any sort of cannabis issues ever. But it is true that THC is a higher percentage now than it was in the 70s. In the 70s, we were smoking leaves. We weren't always smoking flower even. You know, we were like
stems, baby.
Getting the seeds out and the double album. And like, we can all tell you how we did it back then. But anyway, it sounds like, I mean, I'm not even sure exactly what your question is, except so much as like, how do we keep things from going off the rails? Right. Like, what are the guidelines in place? And I think we were sort of getting at that question before with like this idea of like growth at any cost. Like, when does the pruning come in and who does the pruning?
Right. And that's big. I mean, so if we want to use the lessons of the internet for psychedelics, you, as you were saying, internet was government, university, nonprofit. Then we got the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, 1995, written by John Barlow, Grateful Dead lyricist, at Davos. It should have been a hint.
We have somebody in the audience who is very much involved with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Yeah. Is that accurate, John? Am I saying it right? And I am curious what you have to say about all this, honestly.
I'm John Gilmore, old friend of John Perry Barlow, and was in Silicon Valley at Sun Microsystems as employee number 5 with Scott and all those people. Yeah. Anyway, first, the thing about backward links, Engelbart had that working in a single mainframe where he controlled the whole database. He didn't have it working across a huge network. And that is the thing that Tim Berners-Lee left out, because when Berners-Lee invented the web, I was working in a Silicon Valley company. We heard about this thing. We thought, oh, this is kind of interesting. Instead of putting up a Gopher server, we could put up a web server and people could learn about what we're doing. And all you had to do was download a bit of free software and stick it on your server and start typing text, more or less, with a few angle brackets here and there. And it worked, right? It didn't require collaborating with everybody who might ever link to you to figure out how to get back to them. And so Berners-Lee, you know, sort of cut the Gordian knot there and said, we're going to make it easy to build a website, but hard to figure out who else is linking to it.
But let me ask you about the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. So Barlow comes along and writes this thing saying, governments of the world, beware, get away, we're going to handle all this, right? Get rid of, and I understood we hated government then. They did Operation Sun Devil. They were doing a Tipper Gore kind of, you know, Communications Decency Act. So it was go away government, but then we lost regulation and it became free reign for business. Do you know what I mean? It became, and the rest is history. Is there, I'm wondering, did that happen like that? Because you were closer to it, it happening. And is there a lesson in that for us now, looking at how can we safely and competently regulate the psychedelic space rather than seeing government as the enemy here?
Well, so what happened back then is every time we got proposals from government to regulate the internet, they were incredibly stupid. They didn't understand the technology. They were just, you know, putting out proposals so that people would vote for them, right? To look good to their constituents back home. Oh, let's pass something that'll mean those pornographers aren't there on the internet anymore. First Amendment, what First Amendment? You know, And so even the ones that passed, we were able to like beat them 9-0 in the Supreme Court just by bringing a case going, First Amendment, this law, you know, it's... No, I'm not a believer that government will come in and do wise things right. with regard to either technology or psychedelics. Well, I think it has to be the communities that create them that actually work on understanding norms like set and setting, or whatever. They come from culture. They come from experience, right? We have millions of people in this culture who have taken psychedelics and they know what some of the risks are and some of the benefits are. And that core group is going to teach the next 10 million or 50 million people.
I think this is something that is not recognized enough about this current moment compared to, say, 50 years ago. The amount of thoroughly well-understood psychedelic experience that exists in our society today compared to two or three generations ago. And that, in fact, we are now, you know, living with so many elders who have significant lifelong experience with psychedelics, who have been building different containers effectively for psychedelic experience. It has created a completely different context than what was happening back in the 60s and 70s.
Which is why we need lucid news.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's right. Also true.
Seriously.
But just also the one last thought about that is.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, thank you, John. It's worth noting the way that we use psychedelics today compared to 50 years ago, 60 years ago. I knew Allen Ginsberg very well. He was like a mentor, right? Oh. What's happening now in terms of the mainstreaming of psychedelics would have made absolutely no sense to him. He would have seen it through a completely different lens, because back in those days, psychedelics were being propagated by Ginsberg and Leary and folks in the counterculture, essentially to turn people into enemies of the state. They assumed that at that time, things were so rigid, things were so, exactly like that. Let me put it this way. After Kent State, when Richard Nixon went on television and tried to justify the murders of six students who were peaceful demonstrators in Ohio on campus by the National Guard, again, protesting the Vietnam War, 70% of the country was behind him and felt that those students deserved to die. That was the 70s, okay? Today, people are using psychedelics overwhelmingly with the intention to, quote, heal, unquote. That was not something you heard back then.
True.
And that, to me, suggests how differently our society is ready to hold and work with these medicines, these substances. And just to say that there's certainly the opportunity for people to use psychedelics in a way that moves them from subscribing to the popular corporatist paradigm of the moment, but it's not with the same kind of ferocity that was happening back then, where people suddenly felt like they were being thrust out of what they thought of as a contemporary mainstream experience into a world where everything was suddenly turned totally upside down.
Right, but merely being healed makes somebody more resistant to the pull of advertising and capitalism and all that.
Yes, right? I agree.
You know, I feel like right now we're at this crossroads where we haven't developed an immune system to deal with on one hand, the algorithmic misinformation that translates into the psychology. So, for example, I'm fascinated with this notion that Trump and his demographic feel they are the victim, they're enraged, the anger and the other kinds of projections that they have. And eerily enough, it's algorithmically very clear that they're being radicalized by algorithms and misinformation, that the Russians know this. If you haven't seen the documentary, The Social Dilemma, it's a great doc on Netflix. And on the other end of the spectrum, the way that the mind there's a philosopher, Jürgen Habermas, I major in philosophy, so I'm really into him. He coined the term the public sphere. And the public sphere right now is digital at every level. And we have to acknowledge that. But at the same time, the pharmacological relationship to that is we're the most medicated society in human history. the trauma, the anxiety, the uncertainty, that all of these things go into a hyper-capitalist model of the mind. And I'm intrigued by that as an artist. I'm going to Greece in a little bit for a new project where I'm going to, the project's called The Ruins of Democracy, and I'm going to be going to places where democracy's collapsed, and which is a lot, actually, in ancient Greece. Every city-state was a weird laboratory for governance. And so I'm actually getting a chance. The first voting machines were called Kleroterion. And so if you were in a certain couple of city-states who were allied with Athens, you would, it was only men that were allowed to vote. Obviously, there was a tremendous amount of slaves. But Solon, if I'm getting too crazy into history, remind me, here's why. One, oracle. Two, the oracle was tripping. You had to go to the oracle to get a prophecy. Then third part of that is that the weird thing about the way the Greeks and the legacy of democracy that we've inherited is this kind of psychedelic theater. And eerily enough, democracy comes out of this crisis of Athens in a certain time, and they called it the Great Unburdening. Pericles comes along. The entire society had been put in debt by a couple of oligarchs. And he said, look, he did a series of poems in this major area called the Agora in the middle of Athens. And the whole population rose up and said, we don't want debt anymore. In history, it's called the Great Unburdening. And so can you imagine now somebody goes to Times Square and does a rap about getting rid of your credit card? You know, I'm just intrigued by this because that's considered the origins of democracy, at least the Athenian model. And I'm intrigued by that as an artist because partly it's out of theater. And if you think of the 60s, it was a time of psychedelic theater. Every major concert, every major social gathering, people were trying to hit the reset button on their psychology. They weren't sure why. It was fun. It was loud. There was noise. But, you know, by the time the 90s comes along, I'm a DJ and I'm a music producer. I'm intrigued when music becomes far more, the tempos of our time are these kind of quantized beats, hip hop, techno, dubstep, every major style is very specifically quantized rhythms. Why? You know, where do we move from the analog of rock and psychedelia into this kind of electronic medium that everything is very, when I play DJ culture stuff for other musicians from other cultures, they're like, why is it the beats is just relentless? And I'm like, well, that's the psychology of our time. But what you both have been kind of riffing on that I think is the kind of fascination with anxiety and rage that seems to trigger across the entire political spectrum right now. And the reason I keep going back to this term rage is that the online sensibility of Twitter, when Elon Musk recently went to Auschwitz, I don't know if anybody saw this one, and he did a speech saying that, I can't remember, he said DEI, diversity, equivalence, and inclusivity. I always forget what the E stands for.
Equity?
Equity is anti-Semitic. And he made this whole statement about it, and that causes huge uproar. Of course, it's Twitter. So the mechanism of toxicity, rage, all these kinds of trigger points went through the entire spectrum. And this is just the last couple of days. Can you imagine being, personally, I don't think he's a bright of a guy, but this guy goes to Auschwitz and makes a speech about anti-Semitism. And then meanwhile, it's just shocking. And that's the point, like the rage, the anxiety, and the way the algorithms kind of reward that loudest person, craziest person in the room mechanism. And that's why Trump wouldn't have existed without these algorithms, for example. So these are just things that I'm kind of riffing on. And it's been an absolute pleasure to hear the earlier riff about both the 60s and the early 70s. But John Perry Barlow, I still have issues with because his tweets, if you ever look at some of his tweets about Obama, my God.
You were roommates.
Yeah, we hung out for a bit. I was like, we disagree on race and politics, but
you
I like.
You and Barlow were roommates? Because he was also roommates with Dick Cheney.
Yeah,
so you're good brothers,
I can sit across from him and disagree with them and still have we disagree radically. He's I don't know if you guys saw his tweets about using the N-word with Obama. I was like, bro, you got to hit the reset button.
I was afraid to disagree with him in his presence.
I disagree with him. Big time.
You had a question.
Yeah, I was wondering why with these tools of decentralization, digital technology and psychedelics, why would we be having these problems? Because we were supposed to be liberated by this. I mean, I spent a couple of days with Terence McKenna in 98, and he talked about this technology and digital technology, the internet and psychedelics as prostheses that we now all had in our hands. So there should be no monolithic, centralized, oppressive force. We shouldn't be having this. So I'm just wondering why, what's the problem here? What, you know, since we've had these tools, are we ourselves, the decentralized use of it, fucking it up? I mean, I think it's true what you say, but I'm scratching my head. Why is it we're supposed to be free now?
Money.
Who wants to take that?
But it's all in our hands. I mean, it's in the individual's hands. I mean, so why should we be oppressed?
Let me ask you, how many of you guys have a cell phone? How many? Yeah. Everybody, right? So 100%, your cell phone is basically a surveillance device that lets you make a phone call. And
no,
you know,
there's still tools that we, we can create our own.
Sure, make your own cell phone and make your own software to make the cell phone work. Why not?
Psychedelics and digital technology is free for it's open source for the most part. We should be able to.
I actually have an answer for this, and nobody else wants to jump in.
I have a little answer, which is that we're promised connection and we get isolation. It's a real bait and switch.
I wrote books on that. It's common. I used to just blame business, for that, the need to make money. But then I also, the more I learned about the tech bros, I mean, I was with Timothy Leary when he was reading Stuart Brand's book on Nicholas Negroponte called The Media Lab. It was written like 88 or something. And it's talking about all the cool stuff that they were doing at the Media Lab at MIT in the 80s and very early 90s, I guess. And he's reading it and he's circling all this stuff with felt tip pen. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, Tim's so excited. Oh, my gosh. It was one long afternoon. And as soon as he finished the book, he goes, bleh, and he throws it up across the room like he's vomiting. Like, what, Tim? What? What? And he goes, first, less than 3% of the names in the index are women. That's how you know they've got a problem. And this was early to be talking like that. Thank you, Tim. And he said, and second, he goes, these boys are trying to recreate the womb. Right. Their mothers were unable to anticipate their every need right before they knew they needed it, whatever. They want to build a digital womb that will bring them everything they want before they even know they want it themselves, that will anticipate their every need. So they want to basically, as Terence might say, rise above the chrysalis of matter, right, as pure consciousness in a digital egg with a female sex robot servant. And not have to deal with the messiness of reality, the same messiness that Francis Bacon was afraid of. Take nature by the forelock, hold her down, and submit her to our will. And people are doing that with both, right? Both with chemicals and with technology.
This is a very personal response to the question, but my experience of psychedelics opened me up to what I would consider to be a very strongly mystical experience, and starting to see the continuity between that kind of opening that happens with the psychedelic and then the lineage of mystical experiences going back for millennia. None of that is meant to be easy. It challenges you again and again and again to get to the point where you can be grounded and clear in the midst of stuff just coming at you from every direction all the time that tells you to not pay attention to your heart and to how you are connecting to everything around you. And our society's challenge today is to find the societal framing for that reconnection to the heart, which I think psychedelics can be extraordinarily effective at doing, at least in my experience. And talking to each other, not only do we need people doing it, but people should be talking to each other about their experience of doing it, to emerge the forms that are going to work for us in this moment with all this technology, which is frankly extraordinary and opens up so much potential.
I'm always uncomfortable with the word should for some reason. More people should. How do we get people to ... And it's always how do we engender the conditions where safe psychedelic and digital opportunities are available to people?
That's much better. I shouldn't be saying should.
You know what I mean? It's like, I just don't want to be one of those ones who's shooting, who's getting other people to do shit.
No, you're totally on.
I was just going to say a word about intelligence itself and what you were just describing, which is more of a bigger intelligence. There seems to be a moment where artificial intelligence and intelligence in general needs to be redefined in the sense of like connecting. What are we connecting with? Often when we talk about intelligence, it's usually human delusion primarily. We're not connected with the Earth's intelligence or other non-human relations intelligence? I mean, so that seems like an area that is, you know, ripe for growth, definitely.
Maybe what? One or two more questions? Here.
I was just going to say, I mean, where I get stuck with this, we're talking about psychedelics being healing and psychedelics bringing us back to our humanity. But when we have conversations like this, like how do we avoid a situation where psychedelics go the same way as Silicon Alley? We're kind of ignoring the fact that we're socializing ourselves in a system that dehumanizes us from the time we're born. Our schools dehumanize us. Our, you know, the agenda that we are supposed to work in service of a system that benefits a few people, it's, you know, it's kind of like lunacy to think that we're going to raise our kids in this system and then think they're going to build algorithms that make the world better. It's mm-hmm. just, it can't happen like that. So I guess my question is, we need a redo. We need a restart where it's framed around people knowing who they are, knowing how to feel like if I need to go to the bathroom, oh yeah, I should probably go to the bathroom, not wait for somebody to tell me I can go, you know? And so how can we use technology to accelerate a change back toward taking care of ourselves, like use it to create a more humane environment? That's my question.
I mean, I think that the, for me, in response to the beautiful thing we can get from AI is the ability to distinguish human beings from AI, right? We will never be able to compete with artificial intelligence's utility value. We can't. They will always do anything we can name, they will be able to do better than us. But what they'll never be able to do is the stuff we can't name, right? And that's, in the end, our only real difference and advantage to AI is our belief, our faith that there's something else to us, or either in us or out there or connecting us that then the AI have. And that's where it gets spiritual. That's where it gets soulful. So I do think that there's a lesson to be had, a very psychedelic lesson from AI. And that is, once we're able to say, oh, what is it? You know, back to Mr. Rogers, you are special just the way you are. You are sacred just the way you are. Your consciousness is not an emergent phenomenon of complex matter. Your consciousness is a pre-existing condition of the universe. Right. And once you go there, I mean, which is a dangerous place to go, but once you go there, then AI is not scary because that's just stuff. Mara.
Yeah. Okay. You want to do a closing remark? You first, man. You volunteer.
Yeah.
Well,
it might be the only closing remark because if it really closes.
Okay. Yeah. no pressure. Okay. In the tradition of Chuck D from Public Enemy, I say it takes a nation of millions, as we say. Okay, so here we are, and the Union of Concerned Scientists just did their update on the doomsday clock recently. I don't know if anybody saw that. They didn't move the clock. We're about still 90 seconds out from extinction. And I was like, you know, 90 seconds, a lot can happen in 90 seconds. If you're a computer, that's actually a millennia.
In a basketball game.
Yeah, you know. And so I think we have the tool set in front of us to give people much more robust and much more dynamic tools for questioning the world around us. And that's a beautiful and healthy thing. There is a caveat and asterisk behind that, which is, I don't know if our species will make it out of this century. I personally, like, we're in the middle of the sixth great extinction. There's a great book by Elizabeth Colbert, called The Sixth Great Extinction. We are the asteroid that's hit the planet. Mm-hmm. The planet will be here, but we might not be. Now, on the other hand, we have only been here a short, very brief moment in the long, deep history of humanity. There's a great book by Kat Bohannon that just came out called Eve, 200 Million Years of Women's Evolutionary History. It's a brilliant book looking at deep evolutionary time and the way women shaped the deep structural history of our species. Now, there was an evolutionary bottleneck that she points out in a couple different places where a volcano goes off or a certain amount of species dies off. Now, eerily enough, I personally think we're going through an extinction of the imagination right now, and where so many people are using the same software, the same approach to things, this hyper kind of, it's same thing with, we're going through an extinction of rhythms, an extinction of languages across the entire planet. There's a tremendous amount of, as you would say, pruning of all these different alternate paths that we could have taken. Now, in economics, it's called, you know, kind of an opportunity cost. If you speak one language, you might not know six other languages.
Yeah, in biology, they call it junk DNA. I always hate that
term. There is no junk DNA. Nature does not have junk. So my closing comment is that we are just learning to learn. And I feel like that's the beauty of psychedelics, is it opens you up to this questioning of potentiality around us. And that's the healthiest thing we can do in this weird era of late capitalism. Or it's not. Personally, again, if we all come back here 2050 and we're all sitting here, we're not holograms, I'm going to be happy.
Closing remark?
I just want to make a plea for sort of nature and the natural way of doing things and putting down your phones and closing your laptops and having eye-to-eye contact, face-to-face contact, skin-to-skin. My last book came out right as COVID was sort of blossoming, and it was a book about an epidemic that we were having, and it wasn't about COVID. It was about the epidemic of isolation and loneliness, and I really did sort of put a good amount of the blame on our devices that, you know, they pull our eyes away. These babies are like the first generation to grow up where their parents may or may not be cooing and doting over them because they're on their phones, you know, and before that, the one thing a baby was guaranteed was like all eyes on them and babbling, and the baby learns to, you know, have eye contact and to talk and to feel connected. And the kids don't get that now. The adults aren't getting that now. I mean, I see really clearly, just having been a psychiatrist from the mid 90s to now, how much more anxious and depressed and miserable people are. And I do blame technology to some degree. And I'm, you know, I'm watching TikTok and scrolling as much as everybody else, but I could feel in my body, you know, it doesn't take too long before you really start to feel like this is not healthy. It doesn't feel good. If you really feel your body when you're doing it, you could tell right away. And you know, your posture is shitty. And if you're playing video games, like your brain thinks you're exercising, so your brain's happy, but you're on the couch eating Doritos and playing and get, you know, we're separating our minds from our bodies very much. And we're separating ourselves from like our physical experience when we get on our phones and our laptops and everything else. It's like we leave our body. I mean, The Simpsons did this great thing where they just like, they would jack in on their heads and then their bodies would just like completely turn to nothing because they were online. And like, you know, we are doing that. That's concerning. I don't think it's particularly healthy. And I don't know exactly what the solution is. But, you know, what happened during COVID was we all kind of rolled over and said, fuck it. You know, everybody kind of got a case of the fuck it. And as much as we were parents who didn't want our kids going on computers, when COVID happened, the kids were on computers. That's how they were talking to their friends. That's how they were doing their classwork. We all kind of rolled over and said, screw it. We're going to soothe ourselves. We're going to watch, you know, Tiger King and, you know, Great British Bake Off. And we're all just, you know, Netflix and chill. Like everybody just said, screw it. We are going to soothe ourselves with our devices. COVID really did that for everybody. And we never got back from it. And, you know, you're kind of taking your life in your hands when you like walk on the streets, like no one is looking where they're going. There was like a woman in an electric wheelchair who's scrolling and she really almost like knocked me down. Like no one's looking where they're going. Everybody, you know, it's some sort of like digital pacifier. And I know I'm not saying anything you guys aren't already thinking and feeling, but I just wanted to specifically say it.
All right. If I have to close, if we only have 90 seconds left, that's still no reason not to celebrate the ecstasy of our collective existence.
And on that note, I would like to thank our speakers tonight, Julie Holland, Douglas Rushkoff, Paul D. Miller. I want to thank the Athenaeum for holding the space and all of you for coming on out. We would love you to check out Lucid News. We would love you to send us money.
Subscribe.
Yeah. Subscribe.
Invest.
And share. The stories with your friends and colleagues and the people at work who should not know that you're doing psychedelics.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for being on Team Human. I'm delighted to be able to bring you stuff like this, and I'll keep doing so as I get out in the world more and participate in other fun, weird spaces. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.